This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heap coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The U.S. has been really exemplary in the way it has welcomed to its shores some of those people who have been at most risk and at most danger of being persecuted or indeed killed.
That's Leonard Doyle of the International Organization for Migration. He says the U.S. resettlement program is one of the most important in the world. Details coming up.
Also, the AU expresses disappointment in the Trump administration's immigration policy, and no relief from drought is in sight for the Horn of Africa. A UN agency warns close to 17 million people in the region are affected.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, African nations targeted by the new U.S. immigration policy expressed disappointment in the decision to temporarily ban their nationals from entering the United States. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the African Union summit in Addis Ababa that the top diplomat in Africa says the new measure is a sign of turbulent times.
The outgoing head of the African Union Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, says the new American immigration ban not only affects Libya, Somalia, and Sudan, but all African nations.
Excellencies, it is clear that globally we are entering very turbulent times. The very country to whom our people were taken as slaves during the transatlantic slave trade have now decided to ban refugees from some of our countries. What do we do about this? Indeed, this is one of the greatest challenges to our unity and solidarity.
She spoke before dozens of African leaders Monday at the opening of the African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The African Union says Chad's foreign minister, Moussa Faki Mahamat, will succeed Dlamini Zuma, whose term in office has expired. The United States already has complicated, sometimes strained relations with the three African countries named in the immigration ban. The U.S. government does not maintain an embassy in either Libya or Somalia, largely because of security concerns. Somalia's foreign minister, Abdisalem Omar, told VOA his government remains optimistic about its U.S. relations, but the ban is worrying.
We are always sorry to see that people from particularly places where war is being raged now, who are running for their safety, to be told they could not come to the most powerful country in the world, a country that's built on refugees and asylum seekers and people who are running from droughts and persecution and wars and all that. But equally important is that one needs to think about international terrorism and how to defeat it. And we need all to come together, not to discriminate against each other.
Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal told VOA's English to Africa service he sees no reason for Sudan to be among those listed as a state sponsor of terror. That label was affixed in 1993 amid concerns about Sudan's links to Hamas, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda. But he says Sudan has ramped up its counterterrorism efforts. Bilal says he thinks the order will make America almost isolated from the world. Nations that do not have formal relations with the United States, like the disputed Western Sahara territory that claims independence from Morocco, says this affects them too. That region's ambassador at large, Sidi Omar, told VOA the ban is alarming.
I understand that it is being presented as a measure to counter terrorism and violent extremism and so on and so forth, but I'm afraid that the extremist elements may actually benefit out of this and presenting it as something that anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim, which will feed into their rhetoric that the West is against Islam and so on and so forth.
New UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also spoke at the summit, praising African leaders for accepting refugees and urged African nations to remain open to those seeking shelter and safety. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Two, UN agencies say they will continue to actively engage with the U.S. to help refugees who need protection and to offer support on asylum and migration matters. The International Organization for Migration and the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, have issued a joint statement regarding the Trump administration's refugee policy. They say the needs of refugees and migrants have never been greater. Leonard Doyle is spokesperson for the IOM from Geneva. He told VOA's Jody Capua that the U.S. resettlement program is one of the most important in the world.
Well, indeed, because it's traditionally been so extraordinarily generous to some of the most vulnerable people on the planet. So we're not talking about all refugees, which is about 23 million thereabouts. We're talking about a tiny percentage, and the U.S. has been really exemplary in the way it has welcomed to its shores some of those people who have been at most risk and at most danger of being persecuted or indeed killed, irrespective of religion, irrespective of ethnicity, irrespective of what part of the world they come from. And this really we see as a beacon in the world, and it's something which we, of course, would like to see continue.
So what is the IOM and UNHCR doing at this point to engage the U.S. regarding the refugee policy?
I think at the present time, what we're really trying to do is help those refugees who thought they were about to get on the plane in the next couple of weeks and months and start a new life, to help them cope with what is happening for them individually as families. Because if you think about it, many had moved from desperate situations in refugee camps. They'd gone through a long, long process of security clearance, health checks, cultural orientation, so they learn about the new society that they're going to. And as far as they were concerned, their number was coming up and they were about to leave at any minute. So that's now on hold for the vast majority of them, for about 19,000. So unfortunately, they have to go back now to the camps where they've probably lost the spot, lost the humble shelter or home that they've had. They've lost their ration cards. They've lost their livelihoods, because, of course, they work in these camps. That's really what our focus is on now, trying to kind of support these very vulnerable people, many of whom are medical cases that need urgent treatment.
That sounds like a very, very big job. Where do you begin trying to resettle those you already had resettled?
Well, you put your finger on an important aspect of this, is that because the U.S. is the most important, in many respects, the most generous in the resettlement issue, it does not mean it should be the only one. And this is obviously an extraordinary opportunity for other countries now to step forward. One thing to be critical or to make political capital out of this, but I think the reality is these are vulnerable people. And while the U.S. is going through this review or this reset for the next 120 days, it's an excellent opportunity for other countries to step forward, which they've not actually done.
Would you explain that? Which countries do you feel should be taking in more refugees at this stage?
Well, it's certainly not for us to point the finger at individual countries. But we of course, know that Canada has been extraordinarily generous and indeed has offered to take many of those who are stuck or are somehow in limbo. But there are plenty of other countries. Let's look at what globalization has done to the planet over the last 10, 20 years. It's brought economic improvement and wealth to vast areas of the world. Indeed, countries that not too long ago were considered to be beneficiaries of aid are now countries that are moving rapidly up the value chain in terms of income and in terms of quality of life. And these are diverse countries, many of them in the global south, and there surely is space there for people, especially these people who are in such peril, actually. So we're talking about the resurgent economies of Asia. We're talking about Latin America. We're talking about many countries in Europe. I mean, there is no shortage of countries where there's room for refugees at the bottom line.
You say that they can enrich societies. How so?
Well, I think they enrich societies in two ways. One is that the generosity of a country in bringing a vulnerable refugee for resettlement is rescuing somebody from mortal danger in many cases. And then secondly, when that refugee family or refugee comes to a country, I mean, their gratitude is extraordinary. Their willingness to adapt, their willingness to work and to contribute to their new society, and indeed to bring richness to that new society by what they're bringing with them, is extraordinary. So we consider it to be a double victory when you accept a family of refugees for resettlement.
Leonard Doyle is spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
European leaders are reacting to President Donald Trump's executive order that includes the suspension of entry into the U.S. by some foreign nationals. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me from Rome about what some of Europe's leaders are saying as they continue to deal with the migrant and refugee crisis.
Well, there has been a very strong reaction from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She attacked the travel ban, saying that the decisive battle against terrorism does not justify putting people of a particular background or faith under general suspicion. So a strong reaction there, even though she herself is facing a lot more criticism these days because of her compassionate approach to migrants and allowing thousands of migrants to transfer to Germany over the last couple of years.
France's president, François Hollande, has also had some reaction regarding President Trump's executive order.
Yes, President François Hollande has called on European leaders to give a very firm response to this decision by Donald Trump. It's raised a lot of concern in France and in other European countries. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, he said on Sunday that accepting refugees was a duty of solidarity, and terrorism had no nationality. He stressed that discrimination was not the right response. Quite interesting, given that they have had their own experience of terrorism attacks in the last couple of years.
And also, the UK's foreign minister made a statement as well.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, was reluctant to take a stance, saying that it was up to the US to decide its own policy. But the Foreign Minister, Boris Johnson, made a very strong statement on Twitter, saying, "We will protect the rights and freedoms of UK nationals," referring to those that may have been caught up in the drama at the US airports. He said it was divisive and wrong to stigmatize people because of their nationality.
In Italy, I understand there's been actually some mixed reaction.
Well, the Interior Minister warned mixing immigration and terrorism, saying it was wrong and unacceptable to put the two together, and also stressed that treating immigrants as some kind of security risk was counterproductive and led to social exclusion. The Prime Minister, Paolo Gentiloni, said Italy was built on its values. In his particular tweet, he didn't refer to what Mr. Trump said in particular, but he tweeted that Italy was an open, pluralistic society with no discrimination, and that was a pillar of European societies. Other politicians in Italy called for stronger condemnation of President Trump's ban. The Speaker of the House of Parliament said it was unmistakable and alarming sign, whereas the leader of Italy's far-right anti-immigrant Northern League, Matteo Salvini, praised the ban, retweeting a statement by President Trump, and he said that what was happening in Europe was a horrible mess, and referred to the mass migration, the crisis that we're seeing in Italy, as an invasion. So strong words there from the far-right Northern League leader, Matteo Salvini.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Libya's Coast Guard has detained 700 mostly North African migrants after intercepting two boats just a few kilometers from shore. Libyan guards took fire from some of the migrants and their smugglers, but no one was injured in the gunfight just 70 kilometers west of Tripoli. The migrants were likely headed to Italy. In the past 3 days, the Italian Coast Guard has rescued more than 1,300 migrants and recovered three bodies.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. There is no relief from drought in sight for the Horn of Africa. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization warns little, if any, rain is expected in the coming months. More than 17 million people in the region are already listed as being in crisis and emergency food insecurity. The rains that should come between October and December failed, causing major problems in Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, Kenya, South Sudan, Sudan, and Uganda. The FAO says the next rains are not expected for at least 2 months. It says they are crucial for a successful harvest in July.
In December, Reiner's Bible Church International in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State, Nigeria, collapsed, killing scores of people. The tragedy led to the establishment of a commission of inquiry. It has now ended public hearings and is now working on a final report. Investigators have found there were claims and counterclaims between the Uyo Capital City Development Authority and the church founder, Akan Weeks, over securing approval for the building. Reporter Dixon Salami Adama has the story.
The commission, which was set up by Governor of the State, Udom Emmanuel, has also been tasked to effectively resolve the varied disputes arising from the tragedy which occurred during the bishopric ordination of the church founder, Apostle Akan Weeks. Chairman of the commission, Justice Umokoyo Esang, retired, at the inaugural sitting called for memorandum from members of the public, saying that they will rely on undisputable evidence made available to them by reputable associations, experts, and individuals with useful information. In his remarks, the State Attorney General and Commissioner for Justice, Uemedimu Woku, urged members of the commission not to leave any stone unturned in justifying the reason that the commission was set up. He said the setting up of the commission came at a critical time in the history of the state, stressing that they must come up with a report that would serve as a valuable guide to both the government and the public in order to forestall future occurrence of such events. However, the first task undertaken by the commission was to order the State Commissioner of Police to release Mr. Anieti Augustine, the architect who was said to have overseen the church construction. The state government had immediately ordered Augustine's arrest after the incident. Counsel to Augustine, Mr. Ekanem, said his client's release would expose many hidden facts on the church collapse, adding that he was being detained unjustly for merely assisting in supervising what was already planned, drawn, and designed, but that there was more to what led to the collapse. Ekanem also pointed out that his client merely volunteered to assist in the building construction as a professed member and worshipper of that church, and that any punishment meted on him would amount to injustice since he was not the culprit. Meanwhile, the Uyo Capital City Development Authority accused Apostle Weeks of not securing approval for the building of the church. The authority said that the church building had been marked for demolition 5 times because of the land on which the church was erected had been declared as Forest Reserve Area by the state government through a newspaper report of Weekend Pioneer of October 20, 2000. But the apostle has denied any wrongdoing, saying that he duly applied for the land and also paid the sum of 300,000 naira in the process. The chairman of Akwa Ibom State Correspondent Chapel of the Nigerian Union of Journalists, Dennis Udoma, who led the team of journalists to monitor the public hearing, spoke on the issue.
The expectation is that the commission will come out with a white paper that will be able to fashion out blames on whoever is culpable, either Akan Weeks, the founder of the church, or even those people that were involved in various stages of construction of the church. Aside from that, we are expecting that government should contribute to the burial and even the upkeep of those who had some serious injuries during the accident.
A resident of Uyo, Mrs. Ashimari Idongesid, who witnessed the tragedy, bears her mind on the people's expectation at the end of the commission's work.
I pray that this would not be one of those jamborees usually put up by the state government to appear to be working. I just hope that whatever the commission sees and discover from this inquiry would be used to the letter in a way that would give victims of the collapsed church building some sense of justice. The understanding of what has been revealed by the commission is that the whole area was marked out as a government forest reserve area. In any case, from the hearing, we all saw that fingers were pointed at the general overseer of the church. We do hope that the government will not try to shield anyone in this case. We do hope that justice will be done to serve as deterrent to others so that whenever we want to embark on a project, everything we do must be approved by appropriate quarters to avoid setting traps that will take people's life just like that.
So, as the Commission of Inquiry is winding down its work in order to bring out its final report, there are high expectations from the members of the public, especially the families of those who lost their loved ones. In the meantime, anger, anxiety, rumors, claims and counterclaims remains order of the day. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama, reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
In Malawi, pressure is mounting for the government to amend a provision of the Constitution that allows 16-year-old girls to marry with parental consent. Girls' rights campaigners say the provision is in conflict with revised marriage law, which raised the legal age of marriage for girls to 18. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi passed the Marriage, Divorce and Family Relations Bill in 2015 to replace a widely criticized old law which allowed 15-year-old girls to marry with parental consent. Under the new legislation, anyone who marries a girl younger than 18 will serve a minimum jail sentence of 10 years. However, Section 22 of the Malawi Constitution contradicts this. It stipulates that young people between 15 and 18 may marry upon parental consent. Parliament is expected to debate changing the constitution. Until then, parents can challenge the new law, with that raised the voting age for marriage. Joyce Nkandawire is the country director for the US-based NGO Let Girls Lead. She told VOA that marrying a girl at 16 is not realistic, and some girls may later blame their parents for encouraging or allowing them to have husbands at such an early age.
The mind is not fully grown. Think about this girl. She's having problems in marriage, and she's now reminiscing. What will she say? She may not say to the parents, but she will die thinking that it wasn't me, but it was my mother.
She says Malawi should embrace the internationally recognized marriage age of 18, although she would opt for more than that.
If you were given like an option to discuss about the age, would have said 21. But if you, we followed the international law of 18.
Traditional leaders are already ahead of it all. Many of them have enacted bylaws in their communities that allow girls to marry at the age of 21. Treza Kachindamoto is the traditional leader in the district of Central Malawi. She says here we are considering 8 years of primary education, 4 years of secondary education, and another 4 years of tertiary education, and there is also 1 year for internship. She says in this case, at 18 years, the girl will still be in school. She says she feels at 21 years, the girl will be through with her education. She says early marriages also lead to complications at birth and also put the girls at risk of developing fistula. Statistics show that one in two girls marry before the age of 18, one of the highest rates of child marriage in the world. Jessica Bwira is the chairperson of the Women's Caucus in Parliament.
We are very grateful that the traditional leaders want people to get married at that age. But we are also cognizant of the fact that we must not pass a law that we cannot implement. Once you make a law, then what you are saying is anybody at 20, at 19, who gets married will be arrested. Then you better be able to implement that, and you better be able to give enough facilities, which at this moment is really not realistic.
Kabwira, who is also a parliamentarian, says the bill has already been drafted to raise the marriage age to 18 in the Malawi Constitution to match the revised marriage legislation. She says the review is expected to take place in the next sitting of Parliament, probably next month. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Barty here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting Wednesday, February 1st, and continuing throughout the month, we will begin our Black History Month and daily quiz series on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African Americans and African individuals and events. Send us your country's historical moment in February. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers. Get up, stand up. Stand up.